It's the Ghost Intervention edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, school uniforms, climate denial victims, questioning sex offender laws, and ghost belief intervention. Let's begin episode 131.
Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords from politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And I'm Don, your political science philosopher.
And I'm Daniel, econ student and vice president of the UBC Free Thinkers Club.
Well, speaking of the UBC Freethinkers...
Yes. Is there anything going on, free-thinking-wise?
Yes. Today is UBC's Imagine Day, which is basically a big orientation for first years and big party for everyone else who wants to come. All down Main Mall, I think it is, of UBC, there's a whole bunch of booths set up for different clubs, including the UBC Freethinkers Club. So if you're on campus... today, sometime before 5 o'clock, go check us out. We're next to the biology building, sandwiched in between all the Christian clubs that have huge booths and are giving away free stuff because they have lots of money. But we have character.
Yeah, character. That makes a difference.
Yes. And we have awesome buttons with, like, Einstein's face on it. And
wow.
Out on campus. The Atheist A, so
yeah.
Definitely come check out our booth.
Absolutely.
That A is for atheist. I thought it was embryo.
Well, alert listeners will notice that Jenna isn't here with us. She is still on her extended vacation. She'll be back next week on the show.
That's one theory. The other theory is that she's been hunted down by cannibalistic zombies and may return or may not, but you can either choose to believe Ethan or me. It's this free world.
Occam's razor says.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how things go. But in the meantime, we're thinking about how things are going for the space station. And it's not going well for the space station, is it, Don?
No, actually. The space station may soon be abandoned thanks to the failure of a Russian rocket. The last launch to resupply the space station failed for reasons unknown. The rocket went off course and went boom. Until the reason, of course, is discovered and corrected, it's unlikely that the rocket will be used for resupply, and there's actually no chance that it'll be used to carry new crew until they're 100% sure. We all remember with the absolute paranoia that NASA went through when first one space shuttle, then another went boom and lost a few people with that. And so it's understandable that they're somewhat paranoid about what could go wrong with this. The craft itself is essentially right now, with it going bad, it's impossible to resupply the space station or replace the crew. The current crew, though, can be evacuated via lifeboat Soyuz re-entry crafts that are already attached to the space station, so it's not like we're going to have a major TOM incident where someone's lost in space, literally, but it does seem almost impossible for them to get anyone else up there. So although it's going to be empty, the automated and remote systems should ensure that the station remains in orbit. However, there are these unforeseen unknowables that could potentially mean the station could be retired, in quotes, as soon as early next year. If the problem with the Russian rocket isn't solved, the soonest a private or alternative public rocket could be up there is expected to be about 2014, 2015. So, I mean, they were kind of planning to retire it in 2015 to begin with, and then that was extended to 2020, but it looks like it might not even make it to next year.
Yeah. This is such a big problem because quite recently the space shuttle that NASA was using was retired, so it was basically just the Russians that could get anything up there.
Exactly. And, of course, everyone says that private companies would fill in the gap, and Daniel, we know you're such a big promoter of capitalism in the private market. How's that working now?
That's a little beyond the scope of this, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing with the Russian rocket was that it did explode, but there was no one on it, so they didn't lose anyone. So there's still, you know, a certain amount of cautiousness about sending people up there again. But, I mean, I think that this is sort of a trend that's been happening, is that we've sort of downsized our space presence anyway. And there has been a lot of skepticism about the space station itself and if it actually is doing any good for us or if it's just a liability.
Actually, I had heard, too, and I don't know much about this, but on one of my science podcasts I listen to, there's even talk that this might not have been an accident, that there is actually some people who are, and I can't remember now specifically whether it's a anti-American, anti-space station, or just someone who, like myself, might be a little bit against the private companies coming in, about sabotaging this rocket. I know. Future. Well, we'll worry about that later.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of sabotaging things, actually, no, it's we're going to give up on our segues because, well, frankly, they just don't work. But we're going to talk
like a buzzer noise.
Uniforms in school. According to, attendance among middle school and high school students apparently has improved slightly between 0.3 and 0.4 percent when students are required to wear uniforms, according to a University of Houston economist, Isabella Gentile and Scott Eberman, forgive me if I screwed up on the names, who studied uniform policies in a large urban district in the Southwest. The gains were most prominent among female students, who attended an additional half day per school year out of 180 days that they went. According to their report, some 82% of the schools in the districts had uniform laws, uniform requirements, up from 10% in 1993. It is important to note, though, that they didn't actually specify what district they were studying, and some of these numbers seem a little wonky, and that might be because, again, we lack some information about them. According to the reports, quote, school uniforms were more effective at improving attendance in mixed race or primarily white or Asian high schools and middle schools. Which strikes me as just a politically correct way of saying that it was worst or least in African-American Hispanic communities. It seems like they picked everyone out but the ones that are lower. Although, to counteract that, the effects tended to be most prominent among low-achieving students and students who were economically disadvantaged. Which contradicts, I think, the previous line, but... The biggest improvement, though, apparently is in teacher retention at the elementary level. Apparently, teacher attrition fell off by 5% after the uniforms were required, a significant decline considering the mean attrition rate is about 25% annually.
These numbers seem a little small, though, to make any kind of sweeping conclusions, in my opinion.
Not to mention that, is there a strong control in this? Like, were some schools given uniforms randomly and some weren't, and then they're comparing it? Because, I mean, the teacher attrition rate might have fell for another reason.
Well, that was the other thing, too. Yeah, when looking at this here, I mean, one, you know, they do say that 82% of the schools in the district had uniform requirements. So, one, that means either 80% versus 20%, roughly, as your control. But then it's not really control, it should be 50-50. And then if they're comparing 1993 to 2006, which is the data that they were using, again, a lot of other stuff had gone on in that intervening time that may account for these numbers, which, as Ethan correctly pointed out, I mean, half a day in a year, in a school year, doesn't strike me as a huge improvement, especially considering the cost and all that for uniforms. Although an argument could be made on many other grounds that school uniforms are good, this doesn't really, in my mind, make a slam dunk case that it's good for academic reasons.
Mm-hmm. And there's, I don't know if they've perhaps explained a mechanism for making the uniforms, or the mechanism for how the uniforms affect the students' attention or their half a day of extra class that they attend. I don't understand exactly what about the uniforms is doing that. I mean, if it's something that is perhaps tangentially related to them, maybe they could just replicate it with something else, as simple as like a school badge. Who knows?
Yeah, again, you know, a lot of the information that I couldn't find out about the study is very important information to really judge it.
Mm-hmm. Well then, let us move on to...
Maybe a future topic. We'll have to look into more about uniforms and school outcomes.
Well, why don't we shift gears and talk about climate change?
Well, climate change denialism has claimed another victim. Professor Wolfgang Wagner, the editor-in-chief of the climate science journal Remote Sensing, has resigned this week because he allowed to be published a deeply flawed paper in the magazine on climate change. Wagner felt obligated to resign because it was now apparent to him that the paper that was entitled On the Misdiagnosis of Surface Temperature Feedback from Variations in Earth Radiant Energy Balance, wow, what a catchy title, by Roy Spencer and Daniel Barswell was, in his own words, fundamentally flawed and therefore wrongly accepted by the journal. I would also like to personally protest against how the authors and like-minded climate skeptics have much exaggerated the paper's conclusions in public statements. Specifically, he's referring to headlines such as New NASA Data Blows Gaping Hole in Global Warming Alarmism, and Does NASA Data Show Global Warming Lost in Space? Which appeared in Forbes magazine and Fox News Online, both of which attracted a lot of attention. The paper itself was downloaded over 56,000 times the month following its publication. Spencer has frequently appeared in right-wing media in the U.S. criticizing quote-unquote climate alarmism and is the author of the book The Great Global Warming Blunder. The paper in question purports to show that Earth's atmosphere is more efficient at releasing energy into space than is programmed into computer models used to forecast climate change. Essentially, we have these models that predict what future temperatures will be, and this is one of the evidence we say, look, climate change is going to be an increasing issue in the future. And he's stating, well, these climate models don't take into consideration that the Earth radiates heat into space and that more heat radiated into space will compensate, quote unquote, for global warming effects that they have calculated in other areas, which of course negates the fact that we've already seen climate temperature increase on a global scale already. But that being said, Wagner says that he now accepts the peer review process used to test the paper's findings was flawed. Quote, the peer review editorial team unintentionally selected three reviewers who probably share some of the climate skeptic notions as the author. The problem is that comparable studies published by other authors have already been refuted in open discussions and to some extent also in the literature. A fact that was ignored by Spencer and Braswell in their paper and unfortunately not picked up by the reviewers.
I'm a little confused here because I think when you poll climate scientists, it's something like 97% or something, or even higher, are not what you would call climate skeptics. They believe in human-caused global warming. How, if they just sort of pick three of them, what's the probability that it's three people who are going to let a garbage paper?
Well, but I think that's the point.
Yeah.
The probability may be low, but it is still possible for it to happen because, again, these are randomly selected as opposed to vetted, I guess.
And they also could have picked people who just aren't up to speed on the science.
Yeah.
They could have picked, just spitballing, I don't know, a geologist and a oceanographer and someone else.
Or even with the nature of, really in-depth science nowadays is that you have pretty focused discipline. So, you could have people who really study climate science in similar-ish fields, but just not aren't super familiar with the exact thing that they were studying there.
Exactly. And actually, Wagner goes out of his way to point out that the political views of the author and the thematic goal of the study did... of course, didn't alone disqualify the paper from being published. That, it didn't really matter what they were saying or even what their particular views were. That wasn't at issue. But what was it as an issue was that apparently it was bad science that Spencer was doing. Spencer, the author of the paper, is no stranger to academic controversy. He has long maintained that satellite observations showed that atmospheric temperatures were cooling rather than warming until it was shown that the satellite in question was actually suffering from orbital drift. So essentially, the satellite was getting farther away from Earth, and thus the amount of heat it would actually be able to sense was going down, or something as to that effect. Not myself being a climate scientist, and I'm relying on people who actually have degrees. Quote, Spencer and his colleagues have had a long history of minimizing the effect of human-caused climate change. They also have a long history of making serious technical errors, which is, of course, the point that gets them killed. It's not the point that they have a non-standard view or a disagreeable view with the commonly held beliefs. It's the fact that they're actually doing bad science. This latest paper is only one in a decades-long track record of errors that have forced Spencer to revise his work as errors are brought to life. Spencer is well known in the scientific community for publishing high-profile papers that initially dispute global warming, only later to be found to be faulty. And of course, this is an important technique for the quote-unquote climate change deniers, because the paper that he initially published that say, hey, climate change is all a farce, gets a lot of press, and then when he's forced to retract it or correct what he said, doesn't get nearly the same kind of press you get from the first hit.
Well, we've talked in the past few weeks about how studies that have been proven false often don't get updated. They don't publish a new result saying, oh yeah, we were wrong. Yep. And once he gets his story out there, that enters sort of the public, you know, zeitgeist. People sort of get it in their head. And it becomes that much harder to say, well, actually, this guy was wrong. And when you have sort of ideologically motivated news reporting like Fox News and others, that just sort of further perpetuates the climate change denialism, which you know, is kind of following that same sort of track that you have with you know, the tobacco lobbyists.
One of the things, Spencer himself actually responded to the resignation, and if you listen to what he says, you can kind of hear, if you're used to people who are sort of in the pseudoscience sort of realm, how they kind of defend themselves. So he says that, I want to state that I firmly stand behind everything that was written in the paper. It appears that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change gatekeepers have once again put pressure on the journal for daring to publish anything that might hurt the IPCC's politically immovable position that climate change is almost entirely human-caused. I can see no other explanation for an editor to resign in such a situation. That, or the fact that he let a bad science paper get through his purview and published into the journal. That, yeah, that might be another alternative.
Anytime somebody claims that they're the victim of a massive conspiracy is usually a big red flag.
Big red flag, yeah. You know, it's funny, too, because we were mentioning ideological change and related to this. I don't know if many of you mentioned, had heard, but during the winter, of course, places like Fox News and the climate deniers were saying, look, it's cold outside. This proves climate change can't be real. It can't be real. And yet the United States right now is going through one of the worst heat waves it's had in a long time. Texas right now has, I think, the largest fire in Texas history, if not recorded history. It's like miles and miles and miles long. And nobody's saying, oh, look, climate change.
Yeah. Not to mention Vancouver's actually hot today.
Yeah. Wow.
That's so rare.
Are the extreme weather that we've been experiencing the past few weeks, well, not us, but elsewhere in North America.
Exactly. And, of course, that's the important thing to remember. It's extreme weather. I mean, unfortunately, climate change originally came out as global warming, which is sort of true, but global warming means that atmospheric patterns will change. And it is actually possible for some areas. Like, I do believe there are some places where glaciers are growing because there's more precipitation going into these regions than would have normally gone because of the increased energy in the atmosphere. But overall, the entire planet is warming, and other areas are becoming much more drier because that precipitation is going into the glaciers on the mountains.
Yes, this is a very perhaps ill-named phenomenon, but we're kind of stuck with it.
Yes.
Why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
That understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don,
I would like to question sex offender laws. Not for any personal reasons, so don't jump on. Don't look at me like that, guys. No. Apparently, there are two studies in the latest issue of the Journal of Law and Economics cast doubt on whether sex offender registries and notification laws actually work as intended.
So see, these are the things where the police will come to your neighborhood and say, listen, Mr. Smith just moved in. He's actually a sex offender.
I'll explain the differences.
Okay.
In a second.
All right.
Jumping ahead.
You know how eager I am.
One study.
I just really want to hear what you have to say, Don. Continue.
One study by Prescott and Rockoff. That's a funny name. Do sex offender registries and notification laws deter crime? They looked at historical data of 15 states over more than a decade. As laws changed and the use of sex offender registries proliferated, they compared the rates of sex offenses. They looked at both registry laws. These are laws where the offender must register with local law enforcement and provide personal information, and notification laws, where offenders' information are made available to the public, usually online. Each law is intended to work in very different ways. Registration laws work by providing law enforcement officials better means for monitoring of potential offenders, whereas notification laws attempt to use community awareness and public pressure to deter reoffense. For a state with an average-sized registry, and I didn't actually find out what they meant by an average-sized registry, but I assume it's average, a registration requirement reduced crime by about 13% from the sample mean.
So it reduced sex offenses by
13%. 13%, yeah.
Not all crime. That would be quite effective.
Yeah, actually. The drop in crime gets larger as registries grow larger. So if you have a larger registry, you actually get a greater decrease in reoffense. And that's where the second number comes into effect. This indicates that the registry law lowers crime by discouraging offenders from reoffending, as opposed to discouraging first-time offenders.
Do you know if the, like, when it means a larger registry, does it mean sort of a greater number of crimes get you onto that registry?
Yeah, and that was the point, I guess. When they say a larger registry, they mean there are more sex offenders in this one particular state, as opposed to another state which may have fewer sex offenders. So it doesn't seem to deter the first-time offender. But of those people who reoffend, apparently it reduces the rate of them reoffending. In contrast, notification laws may actually undo some or all of the registry's crime reduction power. Their research showed that adding public notification to the average state's registry laws leads to significantly higher levels of total reported sex crimes. Taken as a whole, the research shows that while police registration discourages sex offender reoffending, public notification actually encourages it. Researchers believe that the increase can be accounted for by a diminished, quote, potential loss. That is, one reason an offender may not risk reoffense is because they don't want to lose their job or their standing in the community. Notification laws often mean that the offenders have already suffered underemployment or some form of social ostracization, and that thus there is less for them to lose if they do reoffend.
Yeah. Crimes in general are pretty strongly linked to sort of social upheaval and lack of a job, that kind of thing. So by making it very, very difficult for them to get a job, to have any sort of healthy social life, it's not that surprising that crime will go up with them.
No, and in a number of communities, the idea of harassing these particular individuals to get them out of the neighborhood just makes a more negative environment for them, and them sort of saying, well, screw you, I'm going to do it anyhow because you've already convicted me of a new crime, mm-hmm. sort of thing. So that was one study. Another related study by Amanda Agin, quote, sex offender registries, fear without function, found no evidence that sex offender registries are effective in increasing public safety. She performed three analyses. First, she compared sex crime rates before and after registry laws took effect and found no appreciable change in crime trends. She then compared a population of 9,000 released sex offenders, half to registry states, the other half to non-registry states, and found that the likelihood of reoffense was actually slightly higher in registry states. The last analysis she did was to compare blocks, as in your neighbor, like I live on this particular physical block, mm-hmm. With varying densities of sex offenders. She found that blocks with fewer offenders weren't any safer than those with. Quote, the results show that knowing where a sex offender lives does not reveal much about where sex crimes or other crimes will take place. She concludes that sex offender registries do little to increase public safety, either in a practice or in potential. Now, the big question here. We seem to have two papers. How do we reconcile them? They seem to be contradictory. The first showed a 13% decrease in sex crime rates for registration. The other says almost the exact opposite. It wasn't until 1994 that a offender registry became nationwide in the United States, and the ability for each state to actually enact this is quite varied. So there's potential for disagreement about that. The one thing I noticed that the second article, the Agin article, doesn't take into account is the fact of notification laws. So it is, in theory, if she ignored that fact, maybe that's one of the reasons why the two studies say opposite things. Thoughts?
Well, I mean, it depends on, again, sort of the additional factors of where she's doing these studies. I mean, if she is, just for example, say, taking Texas and Washington State, these are two very different states with different cultures. That could have a significant impact on how they treat sex offenders for reoffense.
Yeah, and again, her focus of her study wasn't so much on the sex offender per se, but on public safety, mm-hmm. which again, you may be apple and orange kind of comparison. Because again, the first one was seemed to be more focused on the idea of recidivism and the idea of is a sex offender going to reoffend. And even in their data, they had noted that in some states, you do have a lot more sex crime, even if the people doing the crime are sort of first timers versus experience.
Well, I mean, even still, like if you took, there are certain cities in America that are known for having the not the most safest streets. So if you took a state that had one of those, you know, East St. Louis type places in them, you could probably get some skewed results.
Yeah.
Especially if your comparison is a relatively safe city.
Yeah. Or like if the comparison over time, you're looking primarily at states where they just naturally, for other reasons, had higher crime rates, mm-hmm. and you didn't have many sort of that offset that. Now, I don't know specifically, they might have controlled more for general crime rates somehow, but if they didn't, that's definitely a possibility.
I also thought it was quite interesting, her block-by-block analysis, which, I mean, again, she's kind of sort of saying, well, you know, is it safer for you to live in a community where there are no sex offenders versus one where there are lots of them? Which goes into the whole principle of the notification laws. The whole point of the notification laws is to let you know how many of them are in your neighborhood so as you can take appropriate precautions. But that seems to be one of her strongest analyses that isn't done in the first one that sort of says, well, knowing where they are, or at least publicly knowing where they are, doesn't seem to be as important as perhaps other factors involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, just the idea I think the notion of sort of ostracizing somebody probably does make them more likely to reoffend. But what could also happen is they could say, well, everybody in this neighborhood knows who I am, and they all hate me. I'm going to move somewhere else, and then they reoffend over there.
Or I don't want to say better, but I live in this neighborhood, and everybody knows what I am. So I'm going to take a vacation in this other place far away, do my evil deed, mm-hmm. where they don't know me, and then I come back and I live here, where I couldn't get away with it here, but I could get away with it there.
Yeah. So it's an interesting...
Well, I like this study because, again, it kind of shows you that depending on how you look at the data, you can get some very different information. And we were talking last week about the prison paradox, and one of the things that we kind of glossed over was how crimes get reclassified over time. And again, it's not mentioned in these studies, at least not that I noted, whether they had taken even that into consideration. Because, I mean, that's another thing that can change dramatically over a decade or two.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to revisit this for a later episode and really dive into this whole notion.
We're not going to re-offend, are we, on this particular...
I don't think we've offended anyone, actually. I think this has been a very civil conversation. But let's go to a commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about ghosts.
Woo!
Yes.
I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
Really?
I love Casper.
Well, that's actually just quite sad. Okay. Well, commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. Stay tuned.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth. Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
I'm this guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star. The planet is just another speck. To think about all of this. To think about the vast emptiness.
Radio Free Thinker is heard Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We're all connected to each other.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're going to be talking a bit about ghosts, not so much ghosts themselves, how do we find them and where are they, but rather how do we talk about ghosts? And this is something that I've had a bit of experience with because I have, and I'm sure many others do, family members who believe in ghosts and have their own unique ghostly experiences they like to tell me about. And I have a number of friends and a number of acquaintances who also believe in ghosts and have told me about their ghostly encounters over the years. And I'm also that kind of person who will, at a skeptics in the pub or certain event, try to find that one person who has a ghost experience and try to talk to them about it because I sort of have this interest in ghosts.
That's always fun.
Well, I think we all sort of have that one sort of pseudosciencey thing that we kind of wish was true, and I think ghosts are pretty cool.
Ghosts are pretty awesome.
They are. I mean,
plus, Ghostbusters is really awesome.
So. Yeah, I mean, if you can walk through walls and all that stuff, I mean, as long as you don't fall through the floor, I think you'd be okay.
What about that whole eternity of, you know, ooh, I'm condemned to be here forever?
Well, those ghosts seem kind of lame.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's so many, like, upbeat ghosts, like Casper, for instance, you know. He's pretty happy. Even though I'm very skeptical of the existence of ghosts, I have a lot of reasons, I have a lot of reasons for that. I think ghosts is a relatively pseudoscientific idea, and there's all these, obviously, reasons why we should be skeptical of ghosts in the first place. But, when we're talking to somebody about ghosts, it can often dissolve into sort of this argument, or it become a very unpleasant conversation. And I'm trying to figure out ways to have a civil conversation. And perhaps because, you know, we're talking about talking to family members or friends, you don't really want to have a very angry argument. You want to have a nice, pleasant conversation.
And if you want to potentially persuade them, a nice conversation is generally the way to go.
But if they believe in ghosts, we should just, you know, ostracize them, call them sex offenders, and just be done with it.
Yeah, that'll work.
We could create special camps where we could put these people for re-education.
Yeah.
I know, that seems a bit radical, but you have a different approach, don't you?
Yeah, my approach is a bit different. And Daniel kind of mentioned the whole sort of tone thing, and I'm not really going to touch on the whole, like, you know, be a dick, don't be a dick, because I think that argument is stupid. This is an argument, this is a way of having a conversation with somebody that's not going to have them start screaming and yelling at you. It actually might if you're, you know, exceptionally, you know, annoying person. But what I've learned is that my system works pretty well for me, dealing with my family, my friends, people that I generally don't want to offend. It works well for strangers and people you just meet. So it works for me, fits my personality. I think it's useful. It may not work for every situation. It might not work for you. It might not work for your family. I'm not telling you this is the only way that you should talk to people about ghosts. I just think it works for me. And you know what? If it works for you, then great. But if not, I'm not forcing you to work this way.
So if I was to tell you right now that I believe in ghosts, I had a ghostly experience, what would you start saying to me?
Well, I think the first step is if someone brings up ghosts, you say, tell me more. Because I think a lot of us, when someone says, I believe in ghosts, or any kind of pseudoscience-y thing, we kind of go, do I really want to do this right now? Forget it, whatever. Or they're just like, you know what, I don't care. But I think that's the wrong attitude to have. If someone says this, you need to be like, ghosts? I want to talk about ghosts, you know?
Well, it's also, too, I mean, what someone means by the term ghost, just like UFOs, which is another common topic that this approach might work, is what they mean by it might not be what you would automatically jump to a conclusion that's what they meant.
Absolutely. And so, as a good example, in Christopher DiCarlo's new book, How to Become a Really Good Pain in the Ass, A Critical Thinker's Guide to Asking the Right Questions, he discusses the Socratic method, which is a method of inquiry used by the Greek philosopher Socrates. And Socrates used to feign ignorance of a topic when discussing something. So he would ask his debate opponent to tell him more or explain his reasoning. And as the discussion went on, Socrates would ask a lot of questions that would demonstrate the ignorance and inconsistency and contradictions of his opponent's logic and information. Now, that's not exactly what I'm suggesting you do here, but it's the same kind of idea. You want the person you're talking to start explaining what they've seen, and you want them to feel comfortable discussing it. You're not so much trying to, you know, trap them in some kind of maze of logic,
yeah,
but you just want to get them going about it.
Not to mention, a lot of the time, if you don't let people talk about what they actually mean enough, a lot of the time you'll sort of end up arguing something that they don't even really subscribe to, and then they just sort of get annoyed at you. Like, if people let them sort of fully explain what they want to say first.
Well, and that also is the other thing, is that lots of times we do sort of cognitive shortcuts where instead of actually going through the whole thing of what we believe in, we just sort of say, well, I kind of believe in ghosts. I'm not going to think about it too much. Therefore, it must be true. And by forcing them to sort of spell it all out as they see it, allows them to identify what exactly it is they're trying to say.
Yeah. And it also, I think, helps them feel that we're just, you know, not there to convince them they're wrong. We just want to know what their experience was.
Although they are wrong.
Well, they might be wrong. I mean, let's be fair. Maybe they found the one piece of evidence we've all been missing. But that leads to sort of the next point, that is, don't get skeptical right away. It's important to not interrupt them. Don't start injecting skeptical quotes or questions like, you know, oh, you saw a ghost in the middle of the night? You must have been dreaming. You know, let them finish their story and listen carefully. Avoid the urge to bring out your copy of The Demon-Haunted World or Why People Believe Weird Things or your, you know, iPhone with your app about ghosts or something.
And don't say Occam's Razor at any point.
Yeah.
Well, at this point.
Avoid sort of skeptical jargon if possible. And as they're talking, I think a good rule of thumb is something that Ben Radford wrote in his book about scientific paranormal investigations. Get the details of their story. You know, as Ben writes in his book about investigating the paranormal, you're often going to have to interview eyewitnesses. And when you're interviewing someone, you want to get the facts of the case, but you don't want to inject your own opinions or explanations. You want them to tell you what they saw and how they saw it as close as the way they remember it. And you don't want to color their memories or their thoughts by injecting things into the conversation. So you're trying to be polite, you're trying to be firm, and you're not trying to mock them as they tell you the situation. And as you're doing this, you're kind of thinking, you know, the how, when, where, what, and sort of questions of a journalist might ask. So you might start asking questions like, what exactly did you see? If they say a ghost, well, what kind of ghost was it? Did it have a body? Was it transparent? Did it have a head? Was it moving? Did you communicate with it? Ask them, what time of day did you see this? What were you doing during that day? Have you seen it often? Have you seen it once or twice? Have you seen other ghosts?
Have other people said they've seen it?
Yeah, exactly. You're trying to get all the sort of factual details. And this is sort of what I guess you could kind of call the note-taking part of the conversation. You kind of imagine you have like a journalist and you have a little notebook and you're jotting down all the facts, right?
Doesn't it sound a bit like an interrogation? I mean, I know you're saying you should do this in a more positive way.
Oh, yeah.
But it does sound like, you know, I'm reporting a crime. So how big was it? What did you lose? Blah, blah, you know.
There's a certain method, like subtlety to how you have to say these things. If you are sort of just like, so how big was it? Like, did you really? No.
Don't play like good cop, bad cop or anything. Like, try to make it clear that you're interested in what they have to say. Like we said at the beginning, you know, be polite, be firm, and make it clear you're not asking this in sort of like a mocking tone. Like, you know, oh, did it have chains on it too? Like, you know. And so as they explain things, the next sort of phase of the conversation is you might start to notice inconsistencies in their story. And if you do, start to ask them about it. But don't get cocky and demand they explain every something. If you've noticed some kind of glaring mistake in their story, point it out to them and say, well, what about, but didn't you say that the ghost had a head, but then you said that it was making noise? Don't start pointing out logical fallacies. Give them the benefit of the doubt and only call them on things that are within their own logic. So for the time being, kind of assume that, okay, ghosts exist. All right. But you just said that the ghost walked through the wall. So why was it able to pick up a chair? You know, like try to approach them on their own terms and hopefully you can open some inroads that way. So one thing that you should definitely not do, don't try to explain things like perception and psychological biases. People are going to have a very bad reaction when you bring that kind of stuff up.
You mean to begin with? I mean, at a certain point, you have to be educational, not just journalistic.
Yeah, but at this stage of the conversation, you don't want to start talking about psychology and you know, a lot of the sort of logical fallacies that we're very familiar with, because oftentimes that will just put the person on the defensive. And it's very important to remember that from their point of view, they've experienced something that defies natural explanation, and that's that. They want it that way, they're happy with it that way, it makes them feel good. As soon as you start to attack that, they're going to go on the defensive, and they're going to just sort of close off and say, well, you didn't see it, so you don't know. And that ends the conversation.
And actually, another psychological thing I think you're getting at too, and probably not quite part of your discussion, but there's a celebrity effect to it too. You know, hey, I saw a UFO, hey, I saw a ghost. That makes me somehow more special. And if you attack them to get rid of that, you're not only trying to say, hey, you're stupid for believing this, but you are somehow less than what you were before.
Right. And you're right. You are going to be tempted to say, oh, well, you know, what you're describing is a very textbook case of sleep paralysis. You know, the unable to move, the feeling of dread, the sensation that you're being watched, all this stuff. Again, like, try not to do that. Instead, the way that I found works best is shift the conversation to your own personal experience. Because while we might realize why eyewitness accounts aren't all that reliable, they probably don't understand that. And that's not an intuitive thing in the first place. So talk about your own experiences. And you say something like, well, that's interesting. And, you know, I had a similar experience where I thought I saw a ghost. What I later realized it was actually such and such. And you don't even have to say it that way. You can talk about some unexplained phenomenon that you saw. Maybe it was a UFO, maybe it was Bigfoot, whatever it was. And if you have any experience investigating paranormal things or the likewise, mention it. Explain as clearly as you can, but explain how you solved it and explain why you were skeptical of it and how you were able to understand it. So this way, you're not attacking their, you know, cherished story. You're saying, well, that's interesting. Here's something that happened to me, and this is how I understood it. So you're kind of giving them an out so they don't feel panicked and on the defensive. And as you're sort of, you know, doing this, you might be able to sort of feel them out for something that they're skeptical of. So maybe they saw a ghost, but maybe they're really skeptical of Bigfoot. So you can say, okay, well, you're skeptical of Bigfoot. Why? Why don't you buy Bigfoot? And as they say, well, there's no evidence. You know, all the photos are blurry. And that's true. The photos are blurry. But what else? And you're kind of playing this sort of game where you're kind of leading them to be skeptical. And this is, I think, a far more effective way of getting them to perhaps think about their own story in a skeptical way, as opposed to, you know, starting out, okay, well, your ghost story was clearly you were dreaming, and here's all the logical fallacy you've just used to try to justify it.
But don't you run into the problem of cognitive dissonance? I mean, it is quite possible for someone to say, listen, I know everyone else who had this experience, it wasn't true. But I know this one was true, at least this one was true, because it happened to me. Mm-hmm. And even if they are a skeptic and you lead them down the path, how do you separate, get rid of that personal, you know, I experienced this and therefore it has to be true because I know it's true.
Yeah, that is sort of the ultimate roadblock. And that's one of the difficult aspects of having a conversation about ghosts or the supernatural with anyone, is that you're eventually going to run into this sort of notion of, well, what if they just compartmentalize and their treasured belief is off to one side and they're willing to accept skepticism about something else, but just not their ghost story. In that situation, you kind of have to say, okay, well, I've gone as far as I can in this conversation. It might be best to sort of leave that part alone and come back at a different time. Because it's important to remember, you're not trying to turn them to a skeptic with one conversation. This is an ongoing process. This is directed to be used at a family member or a friend, something you're going to see often. And you want to kind of bring them in very slowly to this, because it's very easy to piss somebody off and you sort of enter this kind of zone where they believe one thing and you believe the other and that's it. But if you can sort of approach them somewhat on their own level and engage them with their experiences, you have a better chance of opening them up to skepticism later on. So I also have a few general things to not do, again, that can really sort of railroad this conversation. And this is perhaps no surprise, but don't use jargony skeptical language. And we've been talking about jargon a fair bit on the show in the past few weeks. So, you know, don't use terms that only we skeptics know.
Like woo-woo.
Sure, yeah. Try not to use terms like that, because that might rub them the wrong way a little bit. Try not to sound smart. Use appropriate language. If we're talking to someone who hasn't been to university, don't use university terms. Don't dive into like high levels of psychiatry that they're just not going to understand. Don't belittle them. Don't talk down to them. Don't mock them. And you might find that they actually respond well when you don't do these sort of things. And it may sound like kind of silly to point this out, but I've been at Skeptics in the Pub where someone has come in with a supernatural claim and heard skeptics talk to them like this. And I've heard them say, well, interrupt them half through their conversation and say, well, actually, I have Carl Sagan's book on ebook, and I'll just bring up the quote exactly that I want to say. And it's like, that's not going to convince them. And again, you're not trying to convince them in one conversation, but you're trying to at least open the door to having a civil conversation about skepticism later on.
And I think that's one of the places where in the skeptic community you have a certain degree of schizophrenia, is there's a certain degree where we need to be teachers and educators to help bring people into the idea of skepticism, and you don't do that well by hitting them over the head with a stick.
Yeah.
But at the same time, for example, when we're protesting something like Deepak Chopra or whatever, there are some people who aren't in it to learn and won't learn. to which being the asshole is an appropriate response.
Yeah. This is definitely not one of those cases. And again, it doesn't say that you should never, ever use the stick, because there are times when it's quite useful, and there are times when being, you know, confrontational with skepticism is absolutely necessary. This strategy that I'm laying out here really only works in a one-on-one situation with somebody that you have at least some prior relationship with, whether they're a friend or a family member. It does work with a stranger. I've used it before, but again, there is that point where they might just say, well, that's your opinion, I'm going to walk off now.
Do you think it works better too with, and I hate to use this terminology, but with unimportant issues versus important issues? So, for example, we've been talking about ghosts. Mm-hmm. And whether or not you believe in ghosts probably is not going to have a huge effect in your daily life. Maybe you'll go to a seance and blow some money, that sort of thing. But if someone believed in psychic surgery and they had cancer and they were going to go to the Philippines for some psychic surgery, whole different kettle of fish.
Absolutely. If you're ever in a situation where you need to do a emergency skeptical intervention, you're going to use a completely different strategy. Likewise, this is probably not going to work when it comes to religion or anything like that. This is really sort of only useful when it comes to sort of the, you know, not so important skeptical arenas, whether it's ghosts, UFOs, Bigfoot, the paranormal. For anything important, this is not the right strategy. And that's important to keep in mind, because I'm not suggesting you use this strategy for anything else.
Yeah, and important in the sense that it's sort of fundamentally tied up in someone's, like, belief system.
Yeah.
Like, it's very important to, like, how they identify as themselves, not sort of important in an objective sense. Like, someone might be so wrapped up in ghosts that it is, like, so important to, like, how they identify.
Or you may have, there's cascading forms of non-skepticism. So they believe in ghosts, but they believe in ghosts because they believe in souls, and they believe in souls because they believe in the Pope. And that is a whole level of issues. Yes, I'm a skeptic when it comes to the Pope. I don't think it exists.
The Popemobile is just too ridiculous.
He's exactly a figment of somebody's imagination. Right, so, I mean, again, keep those things in mind. It's an interesting strategy, and I've used it. I think it's mostly successful, and I encourage our listeners to try it out on their friends and family.
Sounds good.
Absolutely. Well, we're kind of running out of time here on the show, so we should probably go to our skeptical highlights.
Well, I actually have one more issue that maybe we could bring up. Sorry, I'm slotting this in because we have a little bit of extra time.
All right.
And for those people who read my Science Sunday, the best way to keep in touch with the growing information of the science world, there was a study done recently about mind-altering microbes. People have heard about probiotic bacteria. It's a very current thing to have in your yogurt, is probiotic. Research recently done has shown that apparently in mice, one particular type of bacteria has actually shown significant benefits as far as reducing stress, anxiety, and depression in mice. And it was actually quite a well-done study, and it's very interesting. One of the reasons why I'm bringing it up, I should explain a bit more. Apparently the mechanism is outside of the brain. The human stomach, anybody's stomach, has more neurons than any other part of the body. There's a huge in the particular news article that I was listening to had said it's like the second brain of the human body, and that the interconnection between the stomach and the brain and how it affects our psychological moods is under understood, and there's much more complex than we think. This particular study was at the idea that if you had a good kind of bacteria that stimulated the stomach in a particular way, could this actually alter your psychological performance, the way you feel? And apparently in this particular instance, it worked quite well. I'm bringing up in this particular instance because if you listen to the article, it was on NPR Science Friday, the researcher was quick to point out and reiterate that this does not mean that probiotic yogurt actually works or anything. He just says, this one kind of bacteria worked for mice. If you ate it yourself, you'd probably make yourself sick because it's not a bacteria that actually exists in the human stomach, and that we haven't actually done any human studies, so we have no idea if or how it would work in humans. But it did work in mice, and there's good research opportunities in the future for it. I'm worried that people are going to read half of this article, because I have seen it in more popular press, like the Huffington Post and that sort of thing, where it says probiotics cure mental illness sort of thing, which is just taking this really specific, really minute effect in mice and saying, oh, anything probiotic must be good for everybody all the time. Go out and buy your yogurt. And it's not. So don't buy probiotic yogurt thinking that it's going to improve your mood, irrespective of what you may have read in your magazine, newspaper, etc.
Hmm. Well, you know, we could tie this into the ghost thing. If you're perhaps at a dinner party and you're talking about ghosts, maybe wait till after you eat, because hungry people can be mean.
Yes, although I suspect if there is... So probiotic bacteria means living bacteria. So if there's bacteria on your food to the point where it's noticeable, maybe you don't want to eat there.
Yeah, possibly. Well, now let's go to our skeptical highlights here on Radio Free Thinker.
I have one skeptical... Actually, I have two skeptical highlights, and they're both online. The first one is Eyes on the Solar System. NASA is giving the public the power to journey through the solar system using a new interactive web-based tool. The Eyes on the Solar System interface combines video game technology and NASA data to create an environment for users to ride along with agency spacecraft and explore the cosmos. Screen graphics and information such as planet location, the spacecraft maneuvers, are actually taken from genuine mission data. So it's a very realistic thing. It also has a neat feature which I haven't had a chance to try, but it even has a 3D option. So you see the blue and the red, and it's all sort of 3D-ish, and I don't have the glasses, so I can't tell you how well it works, so it maybe not works very well, but still cool. You can check that out at solarsystem.nasa.gov/eyes. Another website that I came across, and granted, I hope people appreciate it, that we have not talked about 9/11. So I'm just going to bring up one minor thing. It's called Understanding 9/11. The events of 9/11, of course, changed the whole world, and most notably the United States. The 9/11 Television News Archive is a library of news coverage of the events of 9/11 and its aftermath, as presented by U.S. and international broadcasters. A resource for scholars, journalists, and the public, it presents 1 week of news broadcasts for study, research, and analysis. Television is our preeminent medium for information, entertainment, and persuasion, but until now it has not been a medium of record. This archive attempts to address this gap by making TV news coverage of the critical week of September available for those studying the events and their treatment of the media. Essentially, what this is that, I mean, just a recording of all the news programs that had gone on during that week. It's not an editorial, it's not a special, it's not a documentary. But lots of times you hear people, especially people like the Truthers or et cetera, who say, well, you know, this particular news article said this, or people believed it at this particular time. And you can actually go back and see the context to which some of these statements were made and the mood of people at the time, because a lot of things can be taken out of context. And this is providing a historical raw data for other people to go back and analyze. And that can be seen at www.archive.org/details/9/11.
Excellent. Well, I have a skeptical highlight. James the Amazing Randy is coming for a lecture and book signing to Vancouver. James Randi, of course, is the founder of the James Randi Educational Foundation and the creator of the Million Dollar Challenge, is giving a cross-Canada lecture tour hosted by the Centre for Inquiry Canada, starting in Vancouver. Randi will be signing books and speaking on human psychology and how easily it can be manipulated to make people believe in psychics, UFOs, ghosts, and other paranormal and pseudoscientific claims. That is Thursday, September 22nd at 6 p.m. and goes to 8:30 p.m. and is at the Denman Cinema at 1779 Cobox Street in Vancouver. Tickets are $15 advance, $20 at the door, and CFI Canada members get in for $10. So you can book your tickets online or at the door, and there, of course, will be links to the events on our website.
I also hear, too, that Randy and CFI Canada, whatever, is trying to push a Toronto psychic to take up the Million Dollar Challenge, because apparently they had said on a TV broadcast that, oh, yeah, I could probably take that challenge and win it, and then it sort of disappeared from the media since then, when everyone's saying, okay, let's go do it, let's go do it. So I think if anyone out there finds out the name of this particular quote-unquote psychic, they should be tweeting them or whatever, saying, come on, come on, you said you could, you said you could, it's $1 million, go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my skeptical highlight is if you happen to be at UBC right now, go check out the UBC Freethinkers booth at Main Mall and sign up for a club. If you are not, but you're still interested in the club, check out our website at ubcfreethinkers.com or search for us, Freethinkers at UBC on Facebook.
And if right now, or really anytime, you have any comments, ideas, show notes, or anything like that, you can send them to info@radiofreethinker.com and we'll gladly hear what you have to say. We love feedback.
And I understand that the UBC Freethinkers have an upcoming event this weekend.
No, our next event, I believe, is the Breakfast of Champions.
Well, what about the tour of...
Yeah, Toronto? That one, yes. Actually, yeah, on
Friday
at, I believe it's 3 p.m., there's a tour of Triumph, which is the particle collider at UBC. I've heard it's really cool. If you would like to come to that, we are asking that people RSVP info@ubcfreethinkers.com. Send me an email and I'll get you a spot for that. Entirely free. Just show up at Triumph, which is Southern UBC campus, and email me ahead of time.
Excellent. Sounds good. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes on, minds open.
And
every week you have to say it differently.
Yeah.
And this is Daniel saying, I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
Well said.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. Rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truth.